We'll return to our text, the letters and talks of 12th century Chinese Zen master Da Wei, reading from the book Swampland Flowers. This is a letter to a disciple. Gentlemen of affairs often take the mind which assumes there is nothing to attain. Gentlemen of affairs often take the mind which assumes there is something to attain to seek the Dharma wherein there is nothing to attain. What do I mean by the mind which assumes there is something to attain? It's the intellectually clever one, the one that ponders and judges. What do I mean by the Dharma wherein there is nothing to attain? It's the imponderable, the incalculable, where there's no way to apply intelligence or cleverness. This takes some of us years and years and years to understand this point. Until then, we continually employ different strategies in our working on Mu or whatever our practice is. We calculate, we try to manipulate Mu as we see it in the mind. We try to figure it out, which is doomed. You can't figure Mu out. It isn't that sort of thing, because it's nothing. How can you figure out nothing? The linguistic definition of Mu that I like the best is that answer from Zen Master Mu Men, is when he says Wu or Mu is, it's not what you think. It's usually translated as no or not, which is, I understand, is not wrong, but a linguist put it that way. It's just defined it as, it's not what you think. So how could we possibly come to understand Mu through this discriminating mind? The discriminating mind is great for lots of other things, zillions of other things, where we need to use our discriminating mind, but not with Mu. Or who, or what is it? Not with a breath. Zazen is not of that realm. It's learning to detach from these higher brain functions, to quit them. And that's where the practice comes in, the particular practice we're working on, to pry us loose from our thought, our attachments to thoughts. What makes this practice so difficult is that it's so simple. Not easy, but simple in the sense is uncomplicated. It's hard to be simple. It's a gift to be simple, gift to be free. Uh, there's a charming passage by Maurice Maeterlinck, who lived in the 19th and 20th centuries. I'm sorry, I don't know who he is, but this is what he said. If you place in a bottle half a dozen bees and the same number of flies and lay the bottle down horizontally with its base to the window, you will find that the bees will persist till they die of exhaustion or hunger in their effort to discover a way out through the glass, while the flies, in less than 2 minutes, will all have sallied forth through the neck on the opposite side. It is the bees' love of light, it is their very intelligence, that is their undoing in this experiment. Whereas the feather-brained flies, careless of logic, find salvation where the wiser will perish. And so we hear in Japan, they say, just become a mu simpleton, a mu idiot. It's so difficult when we're used to engaging with things with this discursive mind. That's why it takes so long for most of us to exhaust our efforts at figuring anything out and just become mu, become the koan, whatever it is, become the breath, not figure it out. Merge with it. It's the imponderable, the incalculable, where there's no way to apply intelligence or cleverness. An ancient worthy had a saying, "Transcendent wisdom is like a great mass of fire. Approach it, and it burns off your face." Your face, you could understand as our attachment to personality and to self. The word face, as translated into English, has a lot of significance in East Asian countries, about losing face, not losing face, not being humiliated, not approach it and it burns off your face. If you hesitate in thought and speculation, you immediately fall into conceptual discrimination. Yung Chia said, as a previous Chan master, "Loss of the wealth of the Dharma and destruction of virtue all stems from the mind's conceptual discrimination." Da Wei, "Hence we know that mind's conceptual discrimination not only obstructs the path, but also can make people mistaken and confused, so they do all kinds of things that are no good." And then there's that koan, what is your original face? Original. Before you had a face, a self, character, a personality, individual selfhood. Or sometimes, what was your original face before your parents gave birth to you? Or even further, what was your original face before your parents were born? There, take that. Before you had any form, How can anyone figure out the formless? Much less the formlessness of form. He continues, once you have the intent to investigate this path to the end, you must settle your resolve and vow to the end of your days not to retreat or fall back so long as you have not yet reached the great rest, the great liberation. There's not much to the Buddha Dharma. He has to be saying that in a wry kind of way. There's not much to the Buddha Dharma, but it's always been hard to find able people. The concerns of worldly passions are like the links of a chain, joining together without a break. Those whose resolve is weak and inferior, time and time again, willingly become involved with them. Unknowing and unawares, they are dragged along by them. Only if the person truly possesses the faculty of wisdom and willpower will he consent to step back and reflect. Step back and reflect is zazen. It's just what we're doing. Not just in the seated posture, but stopping and withdrawing our attention from our thoughts. That's the stepping back. And reflecting, well, in that, once we're no longer manacled to our thoughts, then we can reflect true mind. It's not thinking back, not that reflect. This, only if the person truly possesses the faculty of wisdom and willpower. Here, of course, we all possess the faculty of wisdom. When you think of wisdom with a capital W, our Bodhi nature, wisdom mind, our wisdom nature. Here it may mean more the faculty of mindfulness, that is noticing, awareness, noticing what the mind is doing, what's going on in the mind at all times, not just the mind but the body and our surroundings. This is more what he would mean by wisdom. And willpower. Some people seem to be come to Zen practice with stronger willpower than others, but luckily, practice develops willpower. We all become stronger in our will, our resolve, if we stick with this long enough. We need willpower to reveal what is beyond the will. That's the wave, the big wave that I mentioned earlier this morning. We need to learn to turn our practice over to that which is greater than us, greater than the will. Gentleman of affairs, I wonder what another translator would make of that, gentleman of affairs, worldly. I think another translator might say worldly people. Make their living within the confines of thought and judgment their whole lives. As soon as they hear someone of knowledge speak of the Dharma in which there is nothing to attain, in their hearts there is doubt and confusion, and they fear falling into emptiness. Fear falling into emptiness. Arguably, the greatest fear that we human beings have. It's another way of talking about the fear of death. Fear of not being. fear of disappearing, which is what happens when we let go of thought. There is no self apart from thought. And when we get free of thought, we're free of self. But in thinking about it before then, in thinking about it, it can, of course, be frightening to think of falling into emptiness. He says, whenever I see someone talking like this, I immediately ask him, is this one who fears falling into emptiness himself empty or not? 10 out of 10 cannot explain. Since you have always taken thought and judgment as your nesting place, as soon as you hear it said that you shouldn't think, immediately you're at a loss and can't find your grip. You're far from realizing that this very lack of anywhere to get a grip is the time for you to let go of your body and your life. Let's appreciate this rhetorical question he poses when he says, whenever I see someone talking about falling into emptiness or fear of falling emptiness, I ask, is this one who fears falling emptiness himself empty or not? Which is another indirect Chinese way of saying, hey, you yourself are empty. Where do you think you're going to fall? And that's the whole problem, is that until we have seen into this emptiness, we conceptualize it. We see it as some other state. That's from giving it a word. We give it a word, and the word emptiness, and then it becomes an it out there, another place. And naturally, it can sound scary. But once we see that we ourselves are this emptiness, then of course the whole matter is resolved. And how are we empty? Well, the most obvious way in which we're all empty is that we're all in flux. There's nothing about the mind or body that has any substance to it. Everything is evanescent, shimmering. Energy. We're energy that has coalesced into a certain appearance of form, of substantiality, of solidity. Talking, of course, about the body, the mind has clearly no substantiality to it. And so we carry around this delusion that there's someone here. This body-mind complex is something that persists from moment to moment, day to day, month to month. Whereas if we had the equipment, the technology to see, as though through an electronic microscope, we would see that we are just energy. We're deceived by our senses. Many people will reach the point in their practice when they're getting deeper into it where they feel this, a lack of anywhere to get a grip. And it can be, of course, very unsettling and can be frightening. But he reminds us, this very lack of anywhere to get a grip is the time for you to let go of your body and your life, which always means let go of your thoughts about your body and your life. He continues in this letter to his disciple, Tun Li, my friend in the path, when we met in Pien in 1126, you were of mature age and already knew of the existence of the great matter. But with your vast erudition, you have entered too deeply into the 9 classics, these are the 9 Confucian classics, and the 17 histories. You are too brilliant, and your lines of reasoning are too many, whereas your powers of stable concentration are too few. You are being dragged along by your daily activities as you respond to circumstances. Thus, you are unable to make a clean break right where you stand. Top-heavy would be another way to describe someone of this cerebral. He continues, if correct mindfulness is present at all times, and the attitude of fear for birth and death doesn't waver, in other words, it's helpful for practice to have some fear about death, then over long days and months, what was unfamiliar will naturally become familiar, and what was stale will naturally become fresh. But what is the stale? It's the brilliance and cleverness, that which thinks and judges. It gets stale fast in Sashin, doesn't it, when we keep finding ourselves dominated by our wit, our conceptualizing, which compared to this realm of no mind comes to, we experience it more and more as adversarial, or at least dusty, dead. What is the unfamiliar? It is enlightenment, nirvana, true thusness, the Buddha nature, where there's no thought or discrimination, where figuring and calculating cannot reach, where there's no way for you to use your mental arrangements. What is the unfamiliar? This is what makes this work so formidable, is we're groping in the dark at best. When it's really working, when we're really on the money, we're groping in the dark. We're floundering. Master once described this process that we're all doing as proceeding toward the obscure and unknown through the still obscure and unknown. It takes a remarkable person who will enter this realm of darkness again and again and again. It takes faith. Tremendous faith, to faith in our ability to navigate and reach where we're going in the dark. But we become more comfortable in the dark. It's just like leaving a bright house, going out in the middle of the night, and our eyes adjust after a while, and we start to feel less nervous, we start to move better. skipping a letter or two here. Here's another one. He says, when people engaged in meditation read the sutras and the stories of the circumstances in which the ancient worthies entered the path, came to awakening, they should just empty their minds. Don't look for the original marvel or seek enlightenment in sounds, names, and verbal meanings. If you take this attitude, you're obstructing your own correct knowledge and perception, and you'll never find an entry. I remember early in my practice, we were having read a couple of Zen stories about monks who would fall or bang their head in something and come to awakening. When it happened to me once, and I thought, "Oh darn, what nothing happened." And then he quotes a Panchan. It's like hurling a sword at the sky. No talk of whether it reaches or not. This is a wonderful image. Hurling a sword at the sky. This takes effort. Some kind of an iron sword, throwing it up to the sky. But effort without concern about whether it reaches or not, without concern about getting anywhere, just the sheer effort itself. And then Dawei says, don't be careless. Vimalakirti said that the truth goes beyond eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind. If you want to penetrate this truth, first, you must clear out the gates of the six senses, leaving them without the slightest affliction. What does affliction mean? It means to be turned around by form, sound, scent, taste, touch, and phenomena, and not detaching from them. It's seeking knowledge and looking for understanding in the words and phrases of the sutras and the ancient worthies. If you can avoid giving rise to a second thought about the sutras or the stories of the ancient worthies entering the path and realize directly what they go back to, then there will be nothing in your own realm or in the realms of others that is not according to your will, nothing of which you are not the master. So it seemed to be a problem in Dawei's time, and you read this from a lot of other Chinese masters, of a monk's making a study out of the words of the master, the koans and the words of the masters, and when they're not ready to at all, they're just puzzling over them and memorizing them and making too much of the words, when the real koan work is seeing beyond the words to what is behind them. But so long as we're our main concern is the words themselves, memorizing them, talking about them, then we're not likely to see what's beyond them. I don't get the feeling it's much of a problem in contemporary American Zen, of people making too much of words and sayings and their meaning. It's one thing we can be grateful for, that people don't fall into that swamp. He continues, in general, since time without beginning, you have overdone the familiar and left undone the unfamiliar. Again, overdone this realm of thought, which is going on pretty much continuously in most people's minds, so it becomes the path of least resistance, just dwelling in thoughts, lost in thought. You've overdone the familiar and left undone the unfamiliar. Even though you may see through it all for a moment, in the end your power in this way cannot overcome the power of your karma. And what is the power of karma? It is what's familiar and stale. And what is the power of the way? It is what's unfamiliar and fresh. Basically, however, there is no fixed measure to the power of the way and the power of karma. Just observe whether or not you are befuddled in the conduct of your daily activities. When you becloud the power of the way, then it is overcome by the power of karma. When the power of karma prevails, then you get stuck wherever you go. When you get stuck wherever you go, then you become attached everywhere. When you get attached everywhere, you consider misery to be happiness. Who would consider misery to be happiness? Well, one way to understand this is craving. We can get so habituated to a state of craving that it becomes, if we're not happy, at least it becomes the norm and it becomes familiar, and it's what we gravitate toward. And especially in this incredibly developed consumer economy, that just the whole engine of it runs on craving, consuming. So we're immersed in craving, and it becomes the familiar for sure. Just the way things are for most people. If you are a real person of wisdom, you will use the power of the way as an instrument to clear away the power of habitual action. Once the power of actions has been cleared away, the way too is empty and false. Thus it is said, the Buddha only uses provisional terms in guiding sentient beings. So what does he mean here? Once the power of actions has been cleared away, the way too is empty and false. This means that you see that this teaching is a no teaching. That are talking about the way, or even the Dharma, is really ultimately a kind of an overlay. That it describes simply what is. Even the word Zen is just a reference to a certain way of practicing and training, but it's not a thing itself. Continues, before you've managed to see through it, you're beset with countless difficulties. After you see through it, what difficulty or ease is there? And then he quotes Layman Pong, one of the three great lay people of in Zen history. The capacity of ordinary people's will is meager. Falsely they say there is difficulty and ease. Detached from form, empty as space, you reach complete accord with the wisdom of the Buddhas. The form of discipline, too, is empty as space. Deluded people consider themselves as upholding it. Unwilling to pull out the root of the sickness, they just fool with the flowery branches. I think here he's referring to getting too caught up in heroic matters of striving. Unwilling to pull out the root of the sickness, they just fool with the flowery branches. The root. So he says, do you want to know the root of the sickness? It's nothing else, just this clinging to difficulty and ease, arbitrarily giving rise to grasping and rejection. If this root of disease is not utterly extirpated, you will float and sink in the sea of birth and death without ever getting out. Now this goes right back to Buddhism 101, where Shakyamuni said that the disease of human beings is our attachment to our desires, to what we want and what we don't want, to our desires and our aversions. And then Sung San picked this up in our affirming faith in mind. The great way is not difficult for those who do not pick and choose. When preferences are cast aside, the way stands clear and undisguised. Grasping and rejection. This is how most people orient their lives. Understandably, of course, if we're attached to having everything the way we want it to, then we will, of course, go in that direction and try at all costs to avoid what we don't like. But so long as we're caught in that net, we're sure to suffer. So there's nothing wrong with it as such. You can do it, but then you're signing up for misery in dividing your experience, your world, into what you want and what you don't want. Sounds so self-evident. Of course, who wouldn't want to devote themselves to pursuing their desires and avoiding what they don't want? But we can see our way out of that through this training of the mind, this assiduous practice over years and years. We come to see these things as less binding on us. Sure, we may still have desires and aversions, but we're not slaves to our desires and our aversions. We glide more gracefully through our circumstances of our lives, and we're not so miserable when we're in circumstances and conditions that are aversive, and we're not so manic or sort of outside ourselves when we get what we want. It's freedom. It's equanimity to not be bound by our desires and our aversions, oscillating back and forth. And then finally, if you want to cut directly through, don't entertain doubts about Buddhas and patriarchs or doubts about birth and death. Just always let go and make your heart empty and open. When things come up, then deal with them according to the occasion. Be like the stillness of water, like the clarity of a mirror, so that whether good or bad, beautiful or ugly approach, you don't make the slightest move to avoid them. Then you will truly know that the no-minded world of spontaneity is inconceivable, beyond our concepts, beyond our knowledge and thoughts. Of course, what he's talking about requires practice, daily practice, supplemented with sesshins. This is how we can begin to approach this marvelous state of clarity and stillness. Time is up. We'll stop and recite the four vows.